Little Foxes by Michael Mopurgo, Chapter 3. Auntie May was ecstatic about Billy's miraculous cure from his stutter. Of course, she had her own theory about the cause of this and was not slow to voice it to anyone who would listen. "I've always said that a happy home is the best cure for all evils. That's all Billy needed, a happy, loving home. And he's not the first, you know. Oh, no. Billy will be the fifth foster child I've looked after since my own boys grew up and went away. And he's a lovely boy, one of the best I've had. You know, no one else would take him. Well, poor little mite. I suppose he's not much to look at, is he? But I don't mind that. Eats me out of house and home, but we mustn't think of that, must we? And dirty, is he dirty? You should see the state he gets in. But there we are. Boys will be boys. After all, we don't do it for the money, do we?" And school, too, claimed responsibility for Billy's new-found voice. Mr. Brownlow was congratulated by the head teacher at the end-of-term staff meeting. "Quite a job you've done there, Mr. Brownlow," she said. "Should give Billy new confidence. And the speech therapist had quite given up on him, you know. Any idea how you managed the impossible, Mr. Brownlow?" "It's a slow process, of course," said Mr. Brownlow, nodding knowingly. "All education is, you know, but I'd say patience had something to do with it." "Yes, patience and faith in one's own tired and proved methods. They love to get up and read, you know. All the others were reading well, and I suppose he didn't want to be different. I mean, who does? That's what did it, I expect. Yes, I do believe he was shamed into it." But the self-righteous glow at home and school soon faded as it was realised that Billy did not wish to use his new voice. He remained as silent and withdrawn as ever, speaking only when he had to and then briefly. At school he would spend hours staring at the distant trees of his wilderness through the classroom window, chewing the end of his pencil. His confidential report read, "Very much below average intelligence. He always seems to want to be somewhere else. Not a good prospect." At home, Auntie May had discovered that to threaten to send him away did indeed bring Billy back home before dark, did bring him in on time for meals, and she was not too bothered what he got up to in between times, just so long as he did not get into trouble or get his clothes dirty. "I'll keep him on for a while, but I don't like the child," she told the social worker on one of his rare visits. "Who does?" came the reply. During that winter, whenever he was not in school, Billy spent every hour of daylight in his wilderness. He often thought of playing truant and would have done so, but he knew Auntie May would have him back inside the children's home the next day if he started that. So immediately school was over, every afternoon he would make for the wilderness, his duffel bag full of the scraps he had secreted in his pockets during school dinner. It was a hard winter that year. The ground froze in late November, and the first snow came early in December. Billy saw himself as the protector of all the wild things in his wilderness. He would spread his scraps evenly throughout the wilderness and then watch them feed. Rampaging rooks and slow crows came wheeling in first, and he would drive them away with his catapult so as to allow the smaller birds' first pickings, the robins and the hedge sparrows and the blackbirds. But he could do nothing for the barn owls, nor for the family of kingfishers. He tried. He purloined sardines from Auntie May's larder, but the kingfishers ignored them. He took some of Auntie May's stew and put it out on a gravestone for the owls, but they never came for it. He broke the ice on the canal each day so that the kingfishers could fish, but it froze over almost as he watched. He had to stand by and see them weaken as the winter wore on. And he had not forgotten his swan. He looked for her every day and searched the canal bank for her feathers. He threw bread out into the canal to attract her back, but there was never any sign of her. And then one day, it was just after Christmas, the owls were no longer in their arched window and the high stone wall of the ruin, and that same day he found a kingfisher lying stiff and dead by the canal. He could see it was one of the young ones, for it still had a white tip to its beak and a mottled breast. The ground was too hard to bury it, so he carried it reverently in his hands down to the canal, hammered a hole in the ice, and slipped it into the water. He could not cry. He was too angry for that. As he watched it disappear under the ice, he vowed he was not going to let the others die. He turned on his heel and ran back to the chapel. He picked up any loose stones he could find and made a great pile of them on the canal bank. All day he went to and fro, until he thought he had collected enough. And then he began to hurl them violently at the ice, that first splintered and then began to crack and break up. And by the time darkness began to fall, he had opened up a 20-foot strip of canal water for the kingfishers to dive into. He was back the next morning after bolting his breakfast. He had expected to find it iced over once again, but although the edges of the ice had encroached somewhat, the water was still open to the sky. He found this difficult to understand, for the night had been as cold as ever. He did not have to wait long for the explanation. He'd been there no more than a few minutes when he heard a strange slapping, slithery sound, and into view came a swan, still brown in her youth, staggering ungainly across the ice before letting herself gently into the water. The neck was longer than he remembered, and the grey had all but disappeared, but as she floated towards him now, the wings billowing like sails behind her, Billy had no doubt that this was indeed his swan come back to him. "So it was you swimming around that kept the ice back," said Billy. "Grown a bit, haven't you? Didn't recognise you at first. How's the wing then?" And as if to reply, the swan rose from the water and beat the air about her before settling back into the water again. "Didn't break the ice for you, you know. Did it for the kingfishers. So don't you go frightening them off, will you now? They need to fish. Come to think of it, there can't be much about for you. Is that what you've come back for? Not just to see me? I can still speak. Been able to ever since that day. And I've still got your feather, you know. I'll get back home now and bring you some of Auntie May's stale crumpets. She never eats them. Don't know why she buys them. Don't go away." And the swan stayed for a month or more after that, and by the end of that time was taking Auntie May's crumpets out of Billy's hand. He talked to her constantly and confessed for the first time what troubled him most: that he belonged nowhere, loved no one, and was loved by no one. Once or twice she clambered out of the canal and allowed him to smooth the feathers on her neck. And it was just as he was saying goodbye to her one evening, running his hand down the neck and over her folded wing feathers, that he saw a large ring of red plastic around her left leg. "Where'd you get that from?" he asked. "You want to tell me, don't you? Funny, isn't it? I mean, you taught me to speak, and you can't even speak yourself." And between them, the boy and the swan kept open the pond on the canal for the kingfishers to feed, Billy breaking away the edges each morning to keep the ice back, and the swan endlessly circling the water so that it was hardly ever still and could not freeze. No more kingfishers died, and with Billy's begging stale bread all over the estate, no other bird in his wilderness died of starvation that winter. Then, one night in March, the frost lifted and the warm spring rain fell in torrents. When Billy arrived early the next morning, he found the canal turned to water again. The swan was not there waiting for him as usual. He called out for her and ran up and down the bank, throwing bread into the water in a desperate attempt to bring her back. But all the while he knew she had gone, and he felt suddenly deserted and rejected. For some days he returned to wait for her, but she never came back. He found he could no longer be happy in his wilderness without the swan. So he made up his mind to leave the wilderness forever, and he promised himself faithfully he would never return. He kept his promise for a month or more, but then both boredom and a new yearning tempted him back. It was a bright day in the spring, still chilled by a fresh north wind, when Billy clambered back under the wire into his wilderness. Already, the skeletal trees were filling out with a new growth of leaves, and the creeper was green again on the ruins. Billy ran across the graveyard to the canal, suddenly convinced that the swan would be there waiting for him, as he had dreamed so often she would be. But the canal was deserted, except for a moorhen that scooted into the reeds on the far bank. Seized with terrible despair, he called out over the canal, "Why don't you come back to me? Why? I saved you, didn't I? Didn't I save your life? I thought you were my friend. Please come back, please." But the whispering murmur of thousands of swarming starlings turned to a roar above his head and drowned his words. Billy made his way back to the chapel and lay down out of the wind, watching the clouds of starlings whirling in the sky over his wilderness. He lay back on a mound in the middle of the chapel under the leaning lime tree and closed his eyes in an attempt to calm the anguish inside him. But all the misery welled up and he could not hold it back. He cried then as he had never cried before. The only hope, the only joy in his life had gone. All that was left for him was the thin-lipped Auntie May and the inhospitable hubbub of his school. He must have cried himself to sleep, for he was woken suddenly. He was lying on his side, his legs curled up so tight that his knees were touching his chin. At first he thought the sound might be the rustling of squirrels in the tree above him. He had seen them up there often enough before, but he had never heard squirrels yapping. Billy sat up. A blackbird piped at him from a blackthorn bush. Billy sat like a statue and waited. He allowed only his eyes to move, and they scanned the trees above him, trained eyes now keen and sharp. When it came again, the sound was distant, and yet it felt close, and it came not from the walls or the trees or the undergrowth around him, but from the ground beneath him. A curious squawking and squealing, almost bird-like, but no bird he knew could growl. He put an ear to the ground and listened, and as he did so he noticed a strange musky smell in the grass. And from below the grass there was a dull yet distinct high-pitched yapping. Billy had heard enough and moved carefully off the mound, stepping slow and soft. He climbed over the stonework and settled down to watch, his heart beating in his ears. One came out first, his white snub muzzle sniffing the air, and he was butted out into the open by the one behind. And then two more emerged almost together until all four fox cubs stood like ridiculous infant sentinels, each one facing outwards, noses lifted, ears pricking and twitching. One of them was looking now at Billy, but seemed not to see him. It was the largest of the cubs, with a redder face than the others and more sharply defined black streaks running from the eyes to the muzzle. The eyes were grey and the nose that pointed at him earth brown. The fox cub sat down neatly and yawned. And Billy found himself yawning in sympathy, a long yawn that lifted the shroud of despondency from Billy's shoulders and left him smiling and happy once again in his wilderness.